This week's episode is brought to you by Grimworks, Thor Neo-san, and Score Wolfchild. Thank you, Grimworks, Thor Neo-san, and Score Wolfchild. It's with the generous support of listeners just like you that keeps our podcasting task force stocked with enough fermented carrot juice to keep our high-powered anti-cosmic flamethrowers incinerating parasitic deities in your local neighborhood or wherever your infestation of angels happens to be. If you'd like to help us keep spit-roasting Seraphim or just hear the second half of this episode, then please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 earns you instantaneous access to our entire library of extended episodes, which are conveniently browsable from right within Spotify. If that's not enough, I'll send you a 5x5 high-quality vinyl sticker of our Big Bunny Baphomet cover art, and you'll get the secret keys to our Discord server where listeners and hosts of the show share stories about that one time Hecka Aster did medical surgery on a fish using essential oils and a glasses repair kit. It was quite the ordeal. If you're enjoying the free section of the show and would just rather save your $5 for an expired carton of discount brownie mix, then please consider giving our humble show a like, subscribe, or share on your social media platform of choice. Better still, share the show with a friend you're certain isn't secretly your shadow handler. It's the little things which add up that keep us clacking away at next week's episode, so thank you. Extra special thanks to Jack Ukaba, one of our listeners who actually helped us prepare the content for this episode. Thank you, Jack Ukaba. In this week's show, we finally ask the question, what the fuck is atheism? We explore the logic that supports it, and what the heck it could possibly have to do with spiritual practice. In the free section of the show, we discuss the spiritual importance of atheism, its likely historical origins, and some of the logical proofs that support it and refute God. We even make a stop to marvel at the problem of evil. In the extended edition of the show, we discuss the logical proofs of Thomas Aquinas, how he used them to prove God, but also how he inadvertently led the big man upstairs to his own doom. It's quite the development. Isaac Newton, the Principia Discordia, and even Aleister Crowley share their opinions on the matter before we wrap things up by discussing the controversial issue of whether or not atheism is, well, a religion or not. Thank you, and enjoy the show. How many atheists does it take to change a light bulb?
So many.
Two. One to actually change the light bulb and the other to videotape the job so the fundamentalists won't claim that God did it. How does an atheist girl get her hair done?
How?
In big bangs.
Oh, come on.
That's funny.
What does a dyslexic, agnostic, and insomniac do?
What?
Stays awake all night wondering if there really is a dog.
There is. For the record.
Why can't atheists solve exponential equations?
Why?
Because they don't believe in higher powers.
Yo, that one's funny.
Yeah, I like that one.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Whole Rabbit, where we do a whole lot more than just calculate the number of nose hairs inside God's left nostril using Kabbalistic hypergeometry. Nay, we also gaze stoically into the hope-snuffing blackness of the vast, yawning abyss, devouring all with soul-snuffing indifference and bottomless hunger, because this week, we're going to finally attempt to answer, what the f*** is atheism? I'm your host, Luke Madrid, also known as the Hack Rabbit. I'm joined this week by the co-hosts, the magneto-electric doggy damsel, Mari-sama.
Dog bless us, everyone.
The magpie with matches, Malachor 5.
It starts to smell like sulfur.
And the reborn unicorn with a French horn, Hecka Astra.
Hello.
I hope you're ready to be attacked by a fedora-wearing mob after this show.
Yeah, not looking forward to it.
No!
Smelling like pizza pockets by the end of the ordeal.
Oh, man. You know, they're wiping the mustard out of their neck beard.
You know what's funny about atheism? If you stop talking about how dumb religion is, there's not much to discuss. In all my years searching for truth, I once tried to be an atheist for a little while, you know, like a free trial run to see if I'd become a regular monthly subscriber. I just ended up deciding that all things considered, it's basically Satanism with Neil deGrasse Tyson instead of boobies and fake blood.
So if hell really exists and God is a thing, I'd rather go to hell than be part of that, whatever you just said. I just can't take Neil deGrasse Tyson in large doses.
Mari, you kind of touch upon a really interesting point. At one point in my life, a friend was, you know, and he's a believer in God. He told me, wouldn't you rather believe in a God that is promising you paradise if you're a good person versus thinking that there is no God and then maybe getting sent to hell? all.
Oh, so it's a hostage situation then.
A little bit. I didn't have the perspective to say that. Yeah, but it is a good argument. It's like if there is even a suspicion that there is a chance at eternal joy and eternal suffering, like you don't know, but there might be, like, well, how do you get into the good side of that if that's true?
He's basically selling cosmic fire insurance.
Oh. I didn't know how to articulate that at the time, for sure. So
that's a good way to put it.
You know, trying to get that prime real estate in heaven. Hedge your bets.
Ironically, even when I was younger, I was almost atheist, but I wasn't. I was agnostic. But I would always brag to people that, you know, when they try to judge you and say, oh, you're going to go to hell if you do that, I would be like, well, I already have beachfront property there, so I'll, you know, I'll see you there.
It's a little risky for R&R!
I like to tell people, yeah, I'll see you there. I'll just be a higher rank.
Oh, even hell has its heroes. So I think sometimes it's good to remind people that all content creators and the media in general come packaged with their own biases. Besides being an important consideration when thinking about God, it also stands to reason that a podcast which deals with everything esoteric, occult, and paranormal would be a bit biased against atheism. Well, that might be the case. Atheism is still a valid school of occult, religious, and philosophic thought, even if it does not recognize the validity of occultism or religion, generally speaking. In short, non-belief is actually a totally valid belief system. Without it, the spiritual marketplace would be incomplete.
I agree. So this topic of atheism, and to dive in deeper into the discussion of it all, it's really important. And if you go online and you try to just look for like a video on atheism from an occult perspective that possibly only a podcast like this one can provide for you, there's really not that much to say. It's a lot of these neck-bearded, fedora hat-wearing assholes kind of complaining about how they were Bible-beaten when they were young, or they were put into some weird cult situations and it cost them a lot of money and suffering, and that's why they're atheists. That's why the philosophy of the religion that their trauma was kind of using as an umbrella to cover up things doesn't mean that the religion itself, and beyond that, the God of some of these religions, is totally ridiculous. So what we have today is like a really negative view on atheism. It's starting to at least arise. There was a time when all this stuff was coming out and it was like, oh, that's like the best thing ever. And then actually humanity made big leaps because they were able to reason with all these contradictions and mysterious things and not be afraid to learn science. And it was no longer, you know, witchcraft to make a potion that could save your relative's life because of a fucking splinter or something.
Well, we're going to get into that. And of course, we have Aquinas to thank for that, but he has the ancient pagans to thank for that. So
there's a causality here. There's a chain of events that all happened that led modern humans to be able to start talking about God existing or not existing. We're that intelligent now and kind of going blow to blow with this cosmic force of creation and non-creation. And we are starting to see ourselves as an agent in all that stuff. And it's pretty profound time to be a human, because before it was pretty wild without reason and actually understanding the atom or how far away the fucking sun is. We come a long way with reason alone.
And before we get too far, I think it stands to mention that occultism and atheism, I think, used to be closer buddies, along with their friend science, because it was the church who wanted to suppress them. And so it may surprise people today, especially atheists, that atheism can be, well, kind of magical. For instance, I've heard it said that the grand arcanum of all magical practice is to treat material matters as if they are spiritual, and spiritual matters as if they are material. In many ways, this magical secret encapsulates the powerful wisdom the atheists have arrived at intuitively. Upon reflection, it can even be argued as the operative principle behind how ceremonial magic functions in the first place. For a magician, after all, her bedroom is not merely a place to sleep or store dirty clothing. No, it's a temple. Meanwhile, her dreams and visions are a place to perform work, the gods and deities there being just little more than tools to interface with. She knows through years of practice that to ascribe them undue reverence would be to spoil the nature of her work entirely. Then, over in Buddhism, a religion which can be argued is atheistic itself, one may perform their day job as if it's a holy meditation, a sacred act. Meanwhile, the sacred meditation is performed with the regularity and fanfare of taking a shit. If we go further, it would then stand to reason that taking a shit would be like giving birth to the universe. A desirable condition to be certain, and one accomplished at least enough times by medical science to enable it the ability to detect disease with stool samples, and subsequently heal its patrons, each one a world of their own, if you will. And while materialism and atheism are not exactly the same thing, they are related for obvious reasons. After all, as atheists contend, the importance of material life is abundantly obvious. It's subject to experimentation, after all. Meanwhile, gods and the miracles they supposedly produce seem only to exist in the pages of storybooks and on the lips of those who believe in them. As a theist myself, I'm capable of playing devil's advocate long enough to admit that material science has not just arrived at conclusions long claimed by mystics of the material world, but made use of these occult properties instead for the benefit of all society. In this way, materialist science has accomplished the miracles claimed by the believers who, more often than not, can only promise miracles, but rarely deliver them. In this way, atheism and materialism are no less magical than any other brand of theurgy. Of course, atheists do not see atheism as a form of theurgy. Far from it. Broadly speaking, atheism is the absence of belief in the existence of deities, although it can refer to a rejection of religion and or the existence of paranormal and spiritual realities in general. Atheism is contrasted with theism, which in its most general form is basically the belief that at least one deity exists. And in my opinion, if you're gonna be a Satanist or a magician, you need to believe at least one deity exists, and that's yourself.
Yeah, totally agree.
Yeah, good argument.
That's some hadith energy for sure.
I mean, what's the point of killing God if you're not gonna take his throne?
Well, the problem with that is then materialism becomes the focal of worship, and then that means the ruling power of humans and like might makes right or whatever, like survival of the fittest becomes.
It kind of by default makes atheism a left-hand path.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of does.
I mean, even the Hindus have the mantra neti neti, which means not this, not this, which, you know, you're supposed to walk around and be like, well, that's not God, that's not God, that's not God, until you suddenly have a dawning of awareness of what is. And the Sufis, they've got one too. It goes, there is no God, but God.
But God.
But God.
He know me.
Phrasing.
So really, for a magic podcast, it's not fair to exclude atheism. That being said, atheism has been around for a long time. But how long exactly? Where can we honestly say it began? Alec Ryrie, a professor of divinity at Gresham College, seems to think that it's been around a lot longer as a lingering suspicion rather than an organized system of thought, which we know it eventually blossomed into by the second half of the 17th century. For instance, in 1660, Spinoza showed that a universe without God was philosophically sound. Voltaire succeeded in attacking the church's moral authority, while Hume took on its metaphysics. And although not an atheist himself, Darwin explained the origins of life without God, and by 1882, the world was ready to hear Nietzsche when he famously declared, God is dead. Prior to this period, however, claims or accusations of unbelief were rather common. For instance, in 1305, a Florentine preacher would warn his congregation that the question, how could it be that God exists, could be heard on the lips of madmen every day. In 1526, a servant boy in Toledo was brought before the Spanish Inquisition for blasphemy, saying before numerous witnesses, I deny God and our fucking lady the whore of the cold-headed asshole.
Great.
Professor Ryrie points out that oftentimes outbursts such as this were often chalked up to madness, as atheism was just not considered a philosophically sound position to take. To use a modern example, atheism was as organized a system of thought as flat Earth is today. After all, to some people, it's just as simple as, the ground looks flat to me, I simply doubt that there's curvature. It seems wrong somehow, which is fair.
That's why that argument will always be compelling to me.
Like, it's very similar. You've got the orthodoxy, which says, the Earth is a sphere. If you don't accept that, it's because you're an idiot. And no, I'm not going to explain it to you because I don't understand it myself. It's the same thing with God back in the day. You know, like, well, of course God is real. That's what everybody knows, right?
I always just say, we do live in a flat world if you're looking at it from the fourth dimension.
Yeah, it's perspective, honestly. But
yeah.
If you know, you know.
It's like, yeah, dude, I dream and I transform into a god. This dimension's nothing to me, man.
Well, don't confuse them with facts.
Right.
That's what I've learned. Okay, so in terms of religion, for many people, bread was bread and dead was dead. No great argument was necessary to doubt religion despite its then looming intellectual authority. The fact that atheism has managed to flip the script on religion in just the last few hundred years should speak to the evolution it has undergone. Keeping this in mind, atheism began in practice long before it did in theory. After all, people frequently choose their philosophies intuitively. While we wish to believe that ideas shape our reality, more often than not, ideas are merely catching up to explain changes in our society, which seem to arise unbidden and inevitably. In this way, it's not so much that philosophy came to attack religion and so people stopped believing, but that, well, people stopped believing and philosophy showed up to explain exactly why. I think this is important to consider because it seems more honest than assuming, as some claim, that non-belief or atheism was the default awareness of early humans. That theists and the religious-minded slowly contaminated and infected humanity with their delusions. But this is little more than the story of the serpent in the garden reimagined with fedoras and British accents. In reality, religious ideas likely arose the same way disbelief did, organically, as an intuition, a means of explaining something felt inwardly. In that case, atheism is a natural evolution of human thought, embracing logic as a primary means of ascribing truth. It was almost destined to happen. It's a natural development of human thinking! At least I think so, anyway. And I'll get more into that as we go.
And just before we move on from that, you did mention Spinoza, the beginning of the, you know, philosophy behind this. It's interesting to note that the concept of Spinoza's God has been mentioned most famously, I guess, by Albert Einstein and other great scientists. It seems to me, from what I've seen, is that the smarter you get and the more logical you become, it wraps back this idea of an orchestrated cosmos that holds some type of intelligence by means of that it executes laws in such an exact manner that it seems like they believe that the organization of the universe, the laws of physics, add up to that God that they talk about. And that, to me, is a great bridge between just straight up atheism and straight up theism.
That's a great argument, and we definitely are going to talk about that later.
Awesome.
Well, it's good you bring up Spinoza now, because at the time, it was revolutionary and a step towards atheism to explain God as the culmination of all those physics, rather than trying to explain the culmination of all those physics as something that God just did one day. And so It sort of led to this evolution of logic taking the primacy over human thought.
This evolution of logic. I like that. What is this logic we're talking about here?
According to Google, it's actually a rapper, but I digress.
Well, if you click on the other page that's like on page 2 of Google, have you ever been there? Page 2 of your search?
Oh, yeah.
It's a mysterious realm.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. Dead internet theory. Anyway, we got to talk about this logic, this idea of logic. What the hell is this? Let's explain that. So the subject of atheism is one of the bigger debates in all of history. It's often a philosophical question that centers around the logical reasons to believe or not believe in the existence of a God. Atheists seem to feel like logic is at the core of, well, everything. And this includes God, of course. It's through deductive logic that atheists fail to see how there can be any defensible stance to support the argument that God exists, and instead take the stance that God does not exist. If it's true that this subject is old, ancient even, then naturally there is the other side of the argument or the debate. Those who argue for the existence of God with the same system of logic.
Turns out this is pretty important because that's where the line in the sand is drawn.
Honestly, at its best, it's the best rap battle ever. If you can manage to just wrap your way through the argument with logic, it's like, God damn it, like this guy just beat me in the debate and with style.
Yes, that is essentially where we're going to be focusing on this episode, are the arguments for and against.
Without rhyming. And making any sense at all, probably. So we know that people who believe in God or gods come from many different cultures and different eras of history, and it's not exclusive to the debates in the church or the monastery. Nonetheless, the subject of debate today is questioning the status quo of ages past, as religion and God has had its hand in the development of modern society. Even today, it seems like the world is dominated by evangelical themes present in our laws and our rights. It's not really until the current age that it is sort of okay to live as an atheist without legal prosecution in one way or another, some kind of prejudice against you.
Unless you're listening to Richard Dawkins, in which case the Taliban is very much in control of the country. And God damn it, you better not blaspheme or they're going to drag you out of your house and poop in your ear.
Yeah, Dawkins is a bit of an asshole.
I wasn't trying to just outright say it, but, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, he's just really mad about it. That's his tone when he's talking about atheism and why your religion sucks and convert to my new idea of being an asshole. everybody, because I don't believe in God. That's how I made money. Good job, dude.
He's a bit of a zealot.
How can you make money off of telling people that you're just as bad as a preacher?
People will pay to hear you say what they actually think.
But if we took Richard Dawkins and put him in the Dark Ages or, you know, medieval times, he'd probably be imprisoned and executed because he honestly probably wouldn't give a shit if he knew where he was at and what time it was. And he'd definitely get his head chopped off laughing or something like a madman.
He'd be a priest.
You think he's, yeah, he might be a bitch.
So whatever is in vogue. Okay, but enough of the even, Dawkins hate. I'm sorry.
Right. Even Dawkins, he's exempt from the discussion because he does try to use logic to make his points. He just takes a weird tone about it.
I mean, we love what he has to say about memes. I mean, we've quoted him on the show as an authority before. So anyway,
let's move on.
Let's talk about how do we start attacking God logically? What, tell us about some of the terms that are important to this mission we're on today.
All right. So logic is my definition. In philosophy, logic is a system of reasoning to find truths. Logic is a deductive method to understand how conclusions are reached by understanding a premise and all subsequent events that reach a conclusion. An easy example of this is if you push a ball from the top of a slide or a ramp, then the ball will roll down, right? That's just logical statement there. Usually, logical analysis can be said in these, if this is true, then this other thing is also true, those type of statements.
So if that example were to be performed in space, then it would not slide. But that's using logic.
Yes, that's a different premise.
See, I used an if and a then, which means I'm smart.
That's what logical debates sound like. But to be simple about it, logic is a study of arguments. And the argument of God existing or not is a little bit complicated, logically speaking. If things are true, then all these, it's like you're talking about a big idea. It's not a simple idea, right? So moving on to the next idea here, valid. A valid argument is one that if the premise is true, then the conclusion will be true as well. Valid arguments do not require the premise to be true, but if they are true, then the logical conclusion must be true too. Now, the other term here is a sound argument. A sound argument is one that is valid and all of its premises are true. A sound argument must always be true. There is no if this premise is true, then this conclusion is also true.
All right, I've smoked a lot of marijuana in my life. Can we have some examples?
Sure. So a sound argument is as follows. All rabbits are mortal. Hack rabbit is a rabbit. Therefore, hack rabbit is mortal.
I don't like this logic stuff.
But that's like saying all A is equal to B. C is A. Therefore, C is B.
Sure, that's simplifying the equation. In the textbooks, they do present it as mathematical algebra formulas where it's just a bunch of A's and B's and things like that. That's much more complicated. This is just a sound argument because we know that rabbits are mortal, right?
Yes, even though symbolically, they symbolize the opposite. I'm just saying.
I agree, but this is science here.
Okay, science. Got it. Science.
So
rabbits.
A rabbit is mortal. Rabbit is a rabbit. Therefore, rabbit is mortal.
Yes.
Okay.
Got it.
That's just logic.
It's a sound argument because rabbits have ears, big ones.
The premise is the same as the conclusion.
I think I understand.
That's a sound argument. You cannot argue against it. Because of the logical necessity of the conclusion, this argument is valid. And because the argument is valid and its premises are true, the argument is sound. Okay?
Got it.
So, now an argument that is valid but not sound. All birds fly. Ostriches are birds. Therefore, ostriches can fly.
Wait a minute. Ostriches don't fly. So, I think I got it here. So, in the first one, rabbits are mortal. That's a true premise. Whereas all birds fly, it's not a true premise.
Yes.
Right.
This argument is valid as the conclusion must be true, assuming the premises are true. However, the first premise is false. Not all birds can fly, like penguins, for example. For an argument to be sound, the argument must be valid and its premises must also be true. So if it was true that all birds fly, then the ostrich would be able to fly. But the premise is false, so it is valid but not sound. You see, there is still a bit of some sense in this argument, in this example. The conclusion does seem to be connected to the premise.
So if your mom is in the kitchen, she would eat all the food. That's only true if your mom is actually in the kitchen. I think I get it. Okay, got it. We got this.
It's fun. It's really fun.
All right.
Well, this is interesting too, because if you imagine that you have a limited scope of knowledge, like if you don't know every single bird to be categorized yet, like if you're still discovering them, you may assume that all birds fly. So you can fall into a trap even using sound logic. I mean, a valid argument cannot be sound because your scope of knowledge beforehand is limited. So that to me makes a lot of sense, because it can be a trap, a logical trap.
All right. So let's look at some ridiculous examples of this, right? All beers are yellow. Heka is a beer, therefore Heka is yellow.
That's all a bunch of baloney.
What?
How am I a beer?
Exactly. The above example is a totally false statement, but not a contradiction. Exactly.
Okay.
It's not directly, it's a false statement. It's not true. It's just not a contradiction either. It's wrong, but not a contradiction yet.
Okay, got it.
Because it's using logic. It follows logic, but it's a lot. It's false.
But if I had a beer and the beer became one with me, then it could be maybe true.
Also, if all beers were yellow, yeah.
Only
also
if it's yellow.
Yellow is the important, yeah.
And you killed all the other beers,
so
right?
You are beer now.
I am the Senate.
You are beer. You are the beer. So it could possibly, maybe, be true. It's a false statement, but it doesn't have to be if we just really close our eyes and pretend.
This is like stoner brain food, by the way.
Yes.
So let's look at a true contradiction here.
Okay. This is like the bottom of the logic pyramid.
Yes.
Okay, let's do this.
All dogs are immortal. Mari is a dog. Therefore, Mari is mortal.
Say what? You just flip-flopped.
Exactly. So if that premise was true, then the conclusion would be false.
Oh, no!
But if that premise is false, then the conclusion is somehow true as it's stated, which is a logical fallacy. It's not sound or valid. It's not even really directly false. It's a contradiction, because some of the parts could be true if this other thing, and it's in motion. It's undetermined.
Cognitive dissonance.
This is like when Terrence McKenna got back from the rainforest and he went to a prominent professor on his camp. And he's like, hey man, listen, so if you eat a bunch of mushrooms, then the entire linguistic fabric of the cosmos, it comes down into your brain, and then you view it with your eyes through your anus backwards with energy, and that's why the world's gonna end in 2012. Am I right?
Well, give me some more drug.
And his professor's like, you're not even wrong.
You know what you were saying, Mal, kind of reminds me of in a previous episode, Mari was talking about a Turing machine, and it's kind of like a religious Turing machine, like if this, then this.
Right. The coding is based off of these philosophical understandings.
Mm-hmm.
It is that binary when you're talking this way about logic.
That's why they call it logic gate, because you have to say the quadratic equation, otherwise they won't let you in to the club.
Yeah, this is what happens when I have too much time to write notes for the episode. I start turning my co-hosts into beers and talking about their mortality.
You've killed all the hosts with just one experimentation with logic. See how dangerous this stuff is? This is why we need God and religion.
So I was the ostrich, but I think I died. That's why my name's not even mentioned, but
at least I know for sure that all dogs go to heaven.
True statement. So these ideas of what is valid or sound might come up when we start to go over some of the qualities that us humans have attributed to God or gods a bit later in the episode.
God's erection is infinitely long and spans both horizons simultaneously. Prove me wrong.
Gonna try to later. I don't know if I'm ready to go looking for a giant dong in the sky, but
my logic is airtight, just like your mother's snap.
Oh, so as logical-minded thinkers, with our fedoras and our neckbeards grown strong, we're able to entertain some of those ideas, to dive deeper into them, to either disprove or prove claims made by us humans when talking about God. As such, in that type of discussion, we are concerned with finding what is true or false about God, if God does exist or not, right? So it's by default that in a logical debate, there is a true and false dichotomy that we wisdom seekers are kind of riding on, and we're trying to understand and fall into the right side of the beach.
Now, for anyone who's confused why we're talking about this, it's because the theists get up on a soapbox and they're like, God has this quality, and this quality. If you just listen to what the theist says, those become the threads in the sweater that we can begin to pull.
But how do these people who get on their soapboxes know that? How do we know anything? That's an interesting question itself. We have two more terms that I want to go over that gives us an idea of how these logical thinkers have phrased this. And it's called epistemology. If you take a philosophy class, epistemology will surely be in one of the introduction chapters.
It's an important branch of philosophy when discussing God because it deals with the problem of what can or cannot be known.
According to logic, there are two ways we can come to know something, a priori and a posteriori.
You know, the Bible says that you shouldn't know people in their posteriori. It's wrong.
So what does a priori mean? A priori means that knowledge is attained through pure reasoning, not requiring any of our senses to deduce the truth. If I say I have one thing and I also have another of that thing, then I have two of that one thing. So I have two, right? This is also expressed as the simple equation 1 + 1 = 2.
I learned about this in that one Jay-Z song.
Mathematics is purely an a priori field of knowledge. Numbers are sort of just made-up concepts, but yet we know that there is a truth in the understanding of how the whole mathematical system works.
One thing I think is important to mention is that human brains are actually better designed to understand math far more than they are language. The problem is that you use language as an overlay to explain the math, so it becomes more difficult. But like the whole peekaboo, it's like a really obvious math equation that kids understand. There's the parent, parent disappear, you know? If a guy walks behind a wall and he doesn't come out the other side, he disappeared. It's something that mammalian brains are just made to do. When I looked up a priori, the word I kept seeing over and over was self-evident. For instance, based on the principles of cause and effect, we all know something had to exist before the Big Bang for it to have happened at all. I don't have to have been there to know that.
Okay, so what does a posteriori mean? On the other end of knowledge and how we get it is this method, and it's based on our senses and our experience, almost like a raw physical method of knowing things, right? It's the hard way of knowing things, the hardware of versus the software. By that, I mean, you know something because you either saw, smelled, felt, heard, or tasted the subject. To put it into scope of the philosophical discussion, when someone makes a claim that at the end of the street there is a house with a green door. In this case, you cannot know that there is a house with a green door until you walk there and see it for yourself. There is no amount of mental reasoning that you can ever achieve 100% certain understanding that that statement is true or false until you go and see it for yourself.
This sounds quite a bit how occult people use the term gnosis, like seeing is believing. The question really is, what is behind the green door?
So again, if we're wondering why these terms need to be brought up before we start talking about if God exists or not. Put it into frame a little bit more. If we put ourselves into the mindset of ancient thinkers, then ponder the qualities that these cultures attributed to their god or their gods for a moment.
Based, of course, on the statements made by the theist, by the believer. And then once we have those premises, we can begin to work out chains of logic and evaluate if there's any possibility that such claims could be true.
Oh, and if you're wondering why we aren't talking about polytheism gods, it's because those gods are no match for the God of the West, I guess.
How dare you question the supremacy of the mighty Yahwim? Actually, I do want to mention how monotheism is important in this regard, but we'll hold off on that for now. What are some of these attributes so often attributed to the God, quote unquote?
So omnipotence, you know, if you don't know, it means all-powerful. When I started thinking about God's potential to be an all-powerful being in a philosophical debate, I asked the question, can the God of the past change the mind of the God of the future, or vice versa? Or would that kind of God be able to draw a round square, as it's famously asked? The answer should be yes, because they're all-powerful, but it is a logical contradiction. A much older version of this criticism of God's potential of omnipotence is whether or not God can create a rock massive enough so that even God cannot move it.
Can God create a wall so high that even he can't jump over it?
I mean, he should be able to, but it's just a contradiction either way.
Yeah.
So omniscience, this is the idea that God is all knowing, of course. Past, present, and future events are all encapsulated in, I guess, the mind of God in his understanding. And since God is assumed to be all powerful, he has the processing power to not get stuck in a sort of information feedback of not being able to learn more, right? He's got that covered. It's weird though, because I can see that feedback loop as almost having more divinity than God that claims to know everything and be all-powerful at the same time.
Well, if you knew everything, you wouldn't have to reason through anything, you know?
I guess. I think there's still a contradiction somewhere in there.
You know, like, if we all exist as thoughts in the mind of God, what's he thinking about? Like, if he knows everything, I think he's confused. That's why we're here.
Right. It just seems that, like, if we were to be able to divine, like truth from the future or something, that we might be able to change our fate, right? Like, is there predetermination as past theists in America thought at one time? You know, are you born and damned for hell at the moment? You know, does God already know that, or can you change that idea? That's kind of scary.
I think that's Calvinism. It's basically the idea that because God is all-knowing, he knew the second you wriggled out of your mother's filth whether or not you would go to heaven or in fact you were damned. And like, you don't know, but God does. You're like dangling like a spider above a bonfire, just stupid piece of shit. Or like, am I supposed to believe an omniscient God didn't know for a fact that Adam and Eve would eat the fruit in the garden? Did he not know about the serpent? Why did he act like he didn't know where Adam and Eve were in the garden after they ate the fruit? None of this makes any sense!
Which, if we consider this next trait that is typically attributed to the supreme God, this idea of omnibenevolence, or totally good, right? Like, completely good God. And I think this is one of the most useful gaslighting traits of theists in favor of God. This idea that he's a good person.
Absolutely.
Theists usually are somewhat joyful and loving towards their God because they feel like the work of God is good. Some more scholarly types will point out how our planet Earth is in the Goldilocks zone itself, where our entire solar system is also in a harmonious dance, so perfect that us humans are able to thrive here. There's also the fact that the way our bodies are symmetrical, the design of our cells, which then work together to make our organs, etc., we're this very interesting entity. It all seems to have some love and benevolence involved, right? It's all working. And this is, in some arguments, proof that God loves us and it's all good, right? But of course, atheists have to always ruin a good thing, and they have to argue over God's benevolence. For some reason, the atheists point to war, starvation, the chaotic nature of space itself, the fact that Konami didn't let Hideo Kojima finish Silent Hill.
All right, you convinced me. There's no God. Let's be real. Yeah,
there's nothing good. It's all bad. You know, they claim that there's no way that anyone could say that God is a good being, given those facts of reality, of course. This presents a huge problem, and thus morality of God can be brought up in the discussion.
Oh, it just reminds me of my favorite argument. My favorite atheist argument is, oh yeah, if there really is a good and benevolent God, then why are kids born with cancer?
I think that's a good argument. I mean, that's really fucked up. There's kids born without buttholes. You know, how, like, some people who are really severe on the spectrum for autism, it's like they have no filter on their perceptions, and just every piece of input is just, like, overwhelming, and they have to deal with this their whole f***ing life. Like, what kind of God does that to somebody? Honestly.
I hear that.
I have my own thoughts about that.
But... You know what? They're f***ing stupid, Maury. No, yeah, God, that was good. Whatever can do that.
I guess I'm dumb. I'm wrong and you're right.
Well, even in the occult religion of Thelema, for instance, God is omnibenevolent, even when it seems otherwise.
Yes, this is true. I just really wanted to yell at you, Mari. I actually agree with you. I just...
Yeah, no, I know. But God works in mysterious ways, y'all. You may never understand what's going on, but something's going on.
I can feel it too.
I mean, this is why I like the Book of the Law. It actually deals with the problem in a nuanced kind of way, in a way that lends itself to hungry brain syndrome, if you will.
It's like a poem.
It's good. That's why I like it. Well, Malachor, please tell us what Hadith says in the second chapter, verse 9 of the Book of the Law.
Remember, all ye, that existence is pure joy, that all the sorrows are but as shadows. They pass and are done, but there is that which remains. Nuit also says in chapter 1 that, you know, after Crowley asks, you know, show me a sign that, like, you know, you're kind of real. And she's like, well, existence itself is like my joy. It's like my ecstasy. Like, the continuity of existence, the fact that everything is not oblivion, is all because I'm happy for you.
And we just are going to talk about occult religion for like 5 seconds. This was a big deal for Aleister Crowley, who had more or less, despite going through all his Golden Dawn initiations and supposedly mastered them, he had more or less been converted to Buddhism. He was more or less a practicing Buddhist. And in Buddhism, life is dukkha. It's suffering. It's awkward. It's one of the noble truths. One of the ways that Thelema diverges from Buddhism is specifically on this verse. And it deals with the fact that the universe is benevolent inherently. It's inherently good. That is a noble truth. Not suffering, but joy is the base level of reality. And to deal with the nuance of the fact that there's so much bullshit in the world, it's that the bullshit is temporary. The bullshit is like an epiphenomena, where the joy and the ecstasy, that's the real thing. That's the base level, and everything else is just a complication of it.
Or an obscuring shadow of it.
I have to pipe up here, because if you think about the way that our minds work and how it's exploited in marketing, like if you're working retail, sometimes you have to show people things that they don't want before they realize that the thing that they do want is this other thing. It's the way that our brains work. We need to be given something that we don't want. We need to be given an opposite, a negative of something.
To propel us to the positive truth, right?
Yeah. So ultimately, if you think of that in relation to spirituality, and because we find these things through our mental realm, we interact with things with our minds, it makes sense that we would ask these questions, or there would be aspects of reality that would make us ask these questions in order for us to be able to find it in the first place.
Well, the problem, though, is that anyone with two eyes looks around and can see very clearly the world is a violent, brutal hellscape, utterly filled to the brim with suffering and death. How could this be possible if God is good? Now, this is commonly known as the problem of evil, because atheism and AI go together thematically like peanut butter and jelly. I thought I'd ask Twitter's Grok to explain it to us. It told me.
Me, Grok, me explain atheism. That's just what I would expect it to sound like. This classic argument posits that if an all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good God exists, then there shouldn't be any suffering or evil in the world. Yet, we see a lot of suffering and evil. So either God is not all-powerful, not all-knowing, or not all-good, or there is no God at all.
That's hard to argue with, isn't it? This is called, of course, the problem of evil. Of course, we've discussed God so much on the show. We already know that the one in the Old Testament was, well, not exactly all good, but more accurately, that all good was of him, along with all the evil and not so good stuff too. So omnipotent, yes. Omnibenevolent, not so much. This was such a big problem for early Christians, we probably have this to thank for the existence of Gnosticism, which, embracing God's omnibenevolence, it found itself identifying the Abrahamic God as a lesser tyrant, because it's really hard to argue that whatever deities in the Old Testament is omnibenevolent, because, you know, it kills babies and stuff. It's just...
Yeah, it just sounds like another, like, powerful human in my eyes.
With thunder farts and angels.
And wrath. Lots and lots of wrath.
And a big sea dragon to flex on them bitches. Someday I'd like to do a whole episode on the problem of evil, but it's a complicated topic. Getting to the bottom of what evil is turns out to be quite maddening, because despite fearing its effects on a deeply practical level, it usually defies definition and classification at every juncture. It's like Yoda says, the dark side of the force that clouds your brain, right? I think a lot of people would reject atheism based purely on the fear of moral chaos. There's plenty of folks who do their best to behave if only because they're afraid of God's punishment. I think this is a compelling point to consider, because atheists always seem to act like being a good person is just built in, and it's religion that's to blame for people acting so horribly. Frankly, I'm not convinced. On the contrary, dispensing with Christian morals and ethics is arguably the part of rejecting religion that really matters. If God was never real to begin with, what's the point of rejecting him unless we change our behavior down here in the real world? Why reject God if the guilt remains? Well, honestly though, like, I really don't know the answer to that. You ask an atheist, like, well, what's keeping you moral? They're like, well, I have an amygdala. My amygdala tells me what to do. It's like, okay, great. Like,
yeah, that's your answer. Let's move on to the next trait that is typically attributed to God. And this is the transcendent God, or the God that is not of this world, as they say.
Ooh,
this is
the belief, fancy.
Yeah. This is the belief that God is not physically present in this realm or plane of existence, never was or ever will be either. The transcendent God is beyond space-time itself.
I think it would profit us to mention that often it's said America is a Christian nation, but in fact, many of the founding fathers were Freemasons and deists. Deists believe that God is so transcendent, he just kind of created the universe, but that's it. He checked out after that. He doesn't, like, come in to deal with morality or miracles or anything like that. Naturally, this is a tough one to prove either way, because how are you going to prove a negative? Like, oh, God's real, but he's not here.
Yeah, that the premise of the argument is just like, wait, you're saying he's not real? Like, I'm saying?
Like, no, he's real, but he may as well not be. Does that make sense?
The baby daddy left, and you can't find him, therefore there is no baby daddy.
Yeah. In fact, this was basically the old-timey version of atheism. Like, it was a little too far, just like, there's no God at all. This was the safe way to claim atheism, and even then, it still wasn't safe. John Locke was one of these fellows, and the amount of things that they accused him of, like, deism was basically the first brand of atheism.
Right, it's like that wonderful meme of, like, some Christian, like, without us, you'd be worshiping the sun, and he's telling some Native Americans, and they're like, dude, the sun is real.
I can see it!
I decided to look around for something else to worship, something I could really count on, and immediately I thought of the sun. Happened like that. Overnight, I became a sun worshiper. Well, not overnight, you can't see the sun at night. The first thing the next morning.
So what is a sun god? You know, this is the immanent god. Of course, you know, we consider this a much more archaic version of God. It's not so mysterious as a transcendent version. The immanent God is one that is manifested in our reality in physical form or forms. This can be the sun, the planets in space, or some pretty eagle that watches you change clothes every day.
If that's the eagle I'm thinking of, he's going to do a lot more than just watch.
Cue the porno based, because it's Zeus. So these manifested gods are much more common in older religions, of course, as we modern humans have now made huge leaps in scientific discovery. We do understand why volcanoes erupt or why that star is moving around and looks fancy. It's a planet. It's not a star, right? It's not Saturn. It's not your god. It's a planet. But still, to this day, we occultists claim to tap into the divine energy that these planets possess. So the notion that these immanent gods are lost to time is certainly not true.
I tend to think that some atheists might even be sympathetic to the idea that Earth is a god of sorts. It is alive. We can touch it. We could argue that it's intelligent, etc. That being said, atheists are quick to point out that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. If God is supposed to exist, where's the damn evidence?
So the last one that I have here for the episode is omnipresent. To quote from Psalms 139 verses 7 and 8.
Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there.
If you don't know, Sheol is hell. So this verse is saying, everywhere I go, you're there, God.
It's like hell, but it's a boring Jewish hell. Does that make sense?
So, an omnipresent god seems to have the permanent remote viewing enchantment on his headgear, or maybe his boots, can just always see things and be everywhere. This trait of God is one of the less important ones in regards to the debate, but we find it present to some degree in nearly every god or pantheon in history. It seems to be an important quality to us humans. I think this is because we humans desire purpose, of course, and gods watching over you can dish out blessings, or at the very least have an effect on your fate. So naturally, we humans assume that some divine force is constantly present and at work in our favor or against us. We have to protect or devote ourselves to these forces. Classical philosophy shoots this idea down by asking, if God is immaterial and not of this world, how can he also exist within this world to truly be omnipresent?
It's a good question. If God is omnipresent, how come he needs a church? Likewise, the issue of God's omnipresence is, in my opinion, a critical juncture in our story about atheism and where it really comes from. Originally, most tribal deities were not typically thought of as being either singular or omnipresent. A god may reside in the earth or the air, but even still, traveling far enough meant encountering the deities of other cultures who, syncretic to yours or not, were seen as having jurisdiction in the regions around where the host culture resided. Deities had turf, essentially. The idea of a purely omnipresent god is largely the brainchild of monotheism, that my god rules over not just our land, but all lands. Not just my people, but all peoples and cultures. It is this very idea of one universal truth that exists the same everywhere at all times, which laid the foundation for the concept of natural law, and by extension, the sciences. By the time we arrive at the New Testament, John 1 boldly announces,
in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made.
In short, this means that the beginning of the entire cause and effect chain of reality is comprehensible as, or even defined by, language. In fact, the original word for word in Greek was logos, the etymological root of the word logic, the idea that we should be able to apprehend the natural universe and its causes through language or logic is very much a natural conclusion of an idea birthed by monotheistic ideation. Well, on the one hand, we may take this as an attempt to shame atheists into seeing their core tenets as little more but the unexamined assumptions inherited from schools of thought they wish so fervently to set themselves apart from, but on the other hand, it also means that God did not so much die or even become murdered as much as he did bring about his own destruction. Perhaps this was the true symbolic meaning of the conclusion of the second Terminator film. We may never know. In either case, Dad threw himself into the molten steel, but he needed a little help to get there from some bold, unhinged rebels along the way. Some big names include Hume, Kant, Spinoza, Freud, Karl Marx, Bertrand Russell, and Sartre. Of all of them, however, the one who is famous for driving the nail into God's coffin is, of course, Friedrich Nietzsche. Friedrich Nietzsche was a German philosopher, cultural critic, poet, philologist, and giant mustache haver who lived from 1844 to 1900. Most famously, Nietzsche criticized the moral and philosophical foundations of Christianity, arguing that they were based on slave morality and promoted weakness and submission. He believed that this morality was a response by the weak to the strong, and that it was used to control and suppress the powerful. Nietzsche advocated for a reevaluation of all values, encouraging individuals to create their own values and live authentic lives, free from the constraints of traditional morality.
His own do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law.
Moreover, Nietzsche's philosophy of life affirmation, particularly evident in his concept of the will to power, is often seen as an alternative to religious belief. He encouraged individuals to embrace life, creativity, and health, rather than seeking solace in a world beyond. In summary, Nietzsche's contributions to atheism lie in his critique of religion, morality, and traditional values, his declaration of God is dead, and his promotion of life-affirming philosophy that encourages individuals to create their own values and live authentic lives. As Christ was once the good news to liberate humanity from the debt of sin, atheism would become the good news to liberate the same from the shackles of the dubious Christ. As fate would have it, this revelation did not occur overnight in the hands of religious opponents, but was the culmination of 2 millennia of steadfastly monotheistic development. Point being, Nietzsche just put the nail in the coffin. He certainly wasn't the one that killed God. That was the job of the monotheists.
That's kind of the underlying narrative. Like, a lot of people take his saying God is dead at face value without delving into the deeper meaning behind it. And he seems to make a point of explaining how, like, God is dead, but it is theologists that killed him.
Yes.
And I think it would be a mistake to take it all at face value and say that he wasn't a spiritual person in any way, shape, or form.
Totally.
Despite his very obvious issues that he took up with the church, and he had his own reasons. But the place that he described, where he said that he received the book Thus Spake Zarathustra, he described that place as a sacred site that he received that from. So even within that, he's kind of implying that, like, I think he was more anti-religion than anti-spirituality, I guess is my point. And he wasn't a moralist, but it didn't mean necessarily that he was against all morality whatsoever, but rather making your own, finding your own in all of these aspects.
Completely agree. And I also think that atheists who are holding the banner of his most famous quote, God is dead, it implies that God existed at one point. So if you're an atheist and you're waving that banner around, you need to reconsider the logic of what the f*** you're doing, first of all.
Well, in my perspective, I also think a lot of his arguments and knowledge has been misappropriated and misused and misunderstood. So, I mean, I'm on board with Hecca. I mean, I'm like...
Similar to Crowley, I'd
say. Why would he say to go and be healthy, embrace life, be creative, find your own will? You know, that's part of what believing in spiritual, you know, higher power, that's a core belief of that. So he's just saying the same thing.
Love is the law. Love under will.
And he's just shooting down dogma, like you said, Hecca.
It's like he's still implying a faith and purpose of some form, and that, like, you find your own purpose.
Yeah, like you can make it up even. And to me, that's still like an extension of, you know, a higher will or a higher, you're following your will. That's exactly like Thelemic. I mean, it is a spiritual thing to say that you can make your own will or follow your own path.
Defy all gods, you know, like blaspheme against everything else that isn't my will. Like, that's some power. That's some divineness for sure, because it's, you're the agent. It's an amazing idea. I'm not an atheist.
It's right in line with the apotheosis of Luciferianism.
Right.
Or apotheosis in general.
It's why any of these things get picked up by masses of people in the first place. Why these philosophies get picked up by people at all.
I mean, most of the atheists that I have met have ended up making these shock value statements sentence and following it up with, you know, like, say, following up God is dead with saying I am God. It's like, that's just apotheosis. You're not anti-religion at all or anti-theology at all. Like, this
right.
is, you're not without God. You found God.
It's worth noting that Darwin's Origin of the Species, the first edition, he wrote it with edits involved because at many points he talked about his God and he was a holy man, but he knew that he wanted to present a scientific idea, so he edited it himself and released it as a scientific workbook. Like, learn these things for science, for reason. And then second edition, unedited, all his anecdotes and commentaries included, talking about God and why these things make sense and how he got there in the first place.
And so if we look at Nietzsche as the culmination or even the progenitor of modern atheistic thought, it's good to point out that he wasn't so much urging people to not believe in God, but encouraging them to become one themselves.
Yep.
What if you'd like to hear more about how the clergy killed God, if the arguments of the great Thomas Aquinas actually hold water, and what atheism has to do with occultism in general? Please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 will not only get you the extended format version of this show, but the extended version of all of our shows going back before the 1920s. I'll even send you a 5x5 high quality vinyl sticker for our Big Bunny Baphomet cover art, which you can worship in perpetuity to the great distress of your friends, family, and neighbors.
You said 1920.
2020s, whatever!
Oh my gosh, should I just go put my Flapper Girl outfit on?
Yes. You're fedora wearing, Tommy gun wielding, rabbit
boop,
folk.
Boop,
boop, boop, boop.
It's all the fedoras, I forgot.
I'm going to work. I might not come back.
Thank you, everybody. Eat carrots and shoot lasers.
Pew, pew, pew.